welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we're excited about the show today. We have some fantastic guests lined up for you today as we are taking on the story of hunger and irrigating food deserts. What's a food desert? Well, you're about to find out. All that and more on this week's An Organic Conversation. Welcome.
Yeah, you know, Helge, that we've talked about this issue many times on our show, and the thing that always surprises me is that is a lot of the studies that are telling us that hunger isn't based on a lack of food in the world. It's more based on a lack of distribution problems, right?
Yes, what's communicated is that it's based on simply lack of food or food production, but more often than not, as we will find out this hour, it's based on more issues and more challenges. As you mentioned, distribution, lack of democracy, and such. We have a great lineup of guests, exciting show today.
But before we get into that, why don't we catch up on the green headlines with Gina Rustani?
Thank you, Mark. Oak Ridge, Tennessee is getting 1,000 tons of nuclear waste from Germany. Radioactive residue left over from the process will be sent back to Germany for disposal, but opponents have voiced concerns that the U.S. will become the world's radioactive waste processor. The company doing the work claims it's safe because Oak Ridgers deal with radioactive material more often than most. In a related story from Vernon, Vermont, the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant will be refueled despite uncertainty about its future. The owner of Vermont's only nuclear power plant, Entergy Corp., plans to move forward with a $60 million refueling despite uncertainty about whether it will be able to operate beyond March, which is when its current license expires. Entergy is locked in a legal battle with the state over the plant's future. Earlier this year, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued Vermont Yankee a 20-year license extension that would allow the plant to remain open until 2032. But the state, which claims it has jurisdiction over the plant's operation, wants the plant to close and has so far not acted on a state certification that it says is needed for Vermont Yankee to remain open. Entergy's lawsuit challenging the state is scheduled to go on trial in September. California's Butte College is poised to be the greenest campus in the country. Butte already boasts a 928-acre wildlife refuge. It uses goats for landscaping, worms for composting, and has LEED certifiable buildings. And now it's going off the grid. It's the first college in the country to be energy independent. The school has added 15,000 panels to its existing 10,000 for a grand total of 25,000 panels, which will produce more energy than the college actually uses. I'm Gina Rustani, and that was this week's Green Headlines.
Thank you, Gina. Wow, Butte College, off the grid.
Go Butte. And it's in a perfect spot for it, right? Chico is hot. They've got a lot of...
Where is Butte College?
It's up by Chico.
Chico, California,
yeah.
Like south, east of San Francisco, a couple hours close to the Sierra foothills.
It's going north, so northeast, yeah.
Yes.
Of San Francisco.
Look for the most sustainable campus
most
in the U.S.,
yeah,
if not on this planet, Butte College, off the grid. Go Butte. Beautiful. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll take a quick break, but stay tuned for our first interview about hunger and how to irrigate food deserts. We'll be talking with the executive director of the Redwood Empire Food Bank, David Goodman, today on An Organic Conversation. More on that when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
The slow parade of fears without pride. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes. I am wise to leave them open for so long. As I have wandered through this world, and as each moment has unfurled, I've been waiting to awaken from these dreams.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today's show is about hunger. We often hear that hunger simply is the result of lack of food. But as we briefly discussed before the break, the story of hunger is more complex. There are many causes for hunger. For example, lack of distribution and sometimes even lack of democracy, where food is available, readily available, but does not reach the people that are hungry. So today we want to shed a more complete light on the work of what is needed and the work, the great work that is being done to address hunger in this country on all levels. We are very excited to have David Goodman today with us. David is the ED of the executive director of the Redwood Empire Food Bank, calling us from Santa Rosa, California. David, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
David, is summer a more busy time for you right now, or does your work pretty much stay the same year-round?
Well, that's a great question. Normally, I get the question around the holidays, and is the holiday season, the winter holiday season, busier? But the answer is that hunger doesn't know what day of the week or month or year it is, and so for hunger relief workers, it's all the same. There's a greater amount of pressure during the winter holidays for that sense of normalcy when everyone is celebrating good times, but from a standpoint of hunger, it's all the same to us.
And it's interesting that when you say there seems to be an emphasis on the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, primarily, and yet not just the work continues. The awareness might be stronger in December. How do you deal with that your work continues pretty much throughout the year? Hunger doesn't stop. The awareness is there during the holidays, and then 3 weeks later, kind of the media has long moved on. And how do you compensate for that, or how do you stay motivated to feel recognized and get the message out that hunger does not stop?
Yeah, well, another great question. The it occurred to me recently that we're fortunate enough to have a season. You know, there are many worthy causes out there in this world that actually don't have a season. So I think that the fact that the nation turns to issues around hunger pretty much between October and the end of January, we use that as a time to capture people's attention, and they are receptive. In terms of what we do during the off season, if you would, is that we remain relevant. For example, here at the Redwood Empire Food Bank, we have a robust summer lunch program for children that are out of school. So over the years, as we've continued to dive deeper into the epicenters of hunger in our community, we've figured out, where are those holes in the safety net, if you would, and one would be when children are out of school. And so that allows us to communicate with the public about the need, and the public in turn says, that's great that you are doing that, and keep up the good work, and they support us.
Hey, David, most of us look at the canned food drives and things like that for the food banks and look at, boxed goods, because that's usually what's asked for because it's probably easily transportable and can be stored. But is there a lot of fresh produce also involved in your program?
Absolutely. At this point, and speaking on behalf of California food banks, I'm a little less adept at speaking for the nation's food bank network. But in California, about half of the food that we are all distributing now is fresh produce. So here at the Redwood Empire Food Bank, we distribute 13 million pounds of food annually, and half of that is fresh produce. And it's not produce that, was sold at a produce market, and then it was marked down, and finally they donated it to us when they couldn't sell it anymore. Instead, through a program of the California Association of Food Banks called Farm to Family, we are now capturing millions of pounds of produce and distributing it. And it's from the fields, it's from the packing houses. It's fantastic. Of course, it does have problems, though.
And, one of the things that you were talking about that direct connection to the farmers, Helge, when he was working at Marin Organic. Helge, you were working on a gleaning program, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. We opened this show today saying that often the food is there, but it doesn't reach the people that need it the most. And we have kind of a program, the harvest after the harvest, with Maroon Organic, where we use place-based education, students coming into the field after the official harvest and gleaning or harvesting, collecting everything that's still there. And we are talking thousands of pounds in one small county. That program started a few years ago, and we were able to address over 10,000 children every week without adding a dollar to the budget of the school. So just as you were saying, David, we are talking with David Goodman, the executive director of the Redwood Food Bank, today here on an Organic Conversation. The food often doesn't reach at the right time the right people, and schools are often the only place of nutrition for children, where the real meal, the breakfast and the lunch, sometimes that's the most important source of nutrition and nourishment. During the summer breaks, that's the hole in the safety net that you were talking about, and you're able to address that through a program specifically for children during the summer break. What else does the food bank, the Redwood Empire Food Bank, do year-round that beyond the holidays, of course, to address that need?
Sure. Well, we have many programs, and in our world, programs are the ways in which we feed people. And we have a number of children's programs ranging from the summer lunch program, an after-school snack program where we just provided our 350,000th, I don't even know how to say that, meal snack for children, their healthy snacks. We have an anti-anemia program that provides nutrition education and iron-rich produce and vitamin C-rich produce for children. We have a number of different children's programs. We have a school pantry program where we bring food to the schools, where then the parents, when they drop off the children or pick up the children, can get bags of groceries. And then we have senior programs that range from simple provisions of emergency food to anti-diabetes or a diabetes wellness program, so that not only do the seniors come for food assistance, but nothing could be worse than somebody coming for food assistance, but they can't benefit from the food provided. So for seniors that are suffering from diabetes, we have a special box for them. And the list goes on. We have 14 different programs, but we've narrowed it down to three initiatives.
Wow.
You're listening to an Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today with us, David Goodman, the executive director of the Redwood Empire Food Bank, calling us from Santa Rosa, California, as we are looking at hunger and all the issues associated with it and the reasons for it.
And David, you've been giving us a picture of Northern California, Sonoma County. Can you give us a picture of what the need for food distribution and hunger is on a national level?
I'm not as strong in that category, but what I can tell you is about 50 million Americans live in food insecure households, and that consists of 33 million adults and about 17 million children. So it is a staggering figure. And, you know, one of the things that I don't spend a lot of time, we have a lot of numbers, a lot of data, a lot of statistics, and I've been doing this for a long time. And I tend to focus my efforts these days around just values and what people think is important. Because if people didn't move when it was 35 million Americans, they probably don't care much if it's 50 million. You know, I mean, the number of people, the magnitude doesn't seem to be the trigger. It doesn't seem to be the thing that gets people to move.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think that these economic times that we're in, of all the times that I've been involved with hunger relief, perhaps there's a greater degree of compassion that's developed because people get it.
Fantastic.
So that's really the question that we wanted to ask you first and foremost. How has the awareness of hunger changed, or how is it changing, and what are you seeing? What are some of the great successes, both in monetary or in numbers, but also in just the awareness, the level of acceptance of talking about it, of
sure.
people, you know, really knowing that there are 50 million, including 17 million children.
Well, I think that first and foremost, I think that it used to be somebody else. It used to be them.
Yes.
And now it's us. I think that to a person, everyone we know has been impacted by this economy. You know, whether it's a child who went to college, did all the right things but can't find a job and now has moved home, a spouse that has lost a job, so now the household's on one income. And the list goes on. An unforeseen accident where now healthcare is out of reach for many people. I think that we all understand what it means to be living on that edge. You know, expressions like living paycheck to paycheck don't mean a whole lot when everybody has a paycheck. But when it goes away, the real significance of what that means comes home to everybody. And so I don't think it's lost on anybody any longer. And during these tough economic times, people turn to basic human needs. So, you know, there are many worthy causes, but I'm sure every single person involved with hunger relief would say that, you know, no matter what's going on, no matter what you're trying to do, whether it's, after school enrichment programs or gang prevention, whatever it is, if the people that you're trying to address are hungry, your program doesn't have a chance of success.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first and foremost, people need to be fed. And, you know, there's a bit of a misconception out there that the basic human needs are food, shelter, clothing. And we disagree with that. We think that the basic human needs are food, air, water. So if you are running out of air and you call 911, you know, the paramedics show up, they give you some oxygen, they take you to the hospital. If you're running out of food and you dial 911, I have some really bad news for the caller. And instead, what happens is they call the Redwood Empire Food Bank or any food bank around the country, and essentially they're suffocating. And our job as food bankers and as hunger relief advocates is to give them an accurate, adequate referral to meet the needs of whatever their situation is and get them to a food resource so that they can begin to breathe again, if you would.
Mm-hmm. So how, which brings us to the last question of who is qualified? Who can enter? Who can access your resources? Is there a limit? How do you check on their status? Does it matter? Can anyone contact their local food bank and get help?
Anybody can contact their local food bank and get help. Depending on the program that we're trying to direct them to, there are a variety of qualifications. And they range from anything from self-verified, which means they look at a poster that says, do you meet this standard? And they self-verify. So they say, yeah, that's me. I qualify. Sometimes we look at the age of the child, the age of the senior, their household income. But at the end of the day, if we had to choose here at the Redwood Empire Food Bank, the very fact that people are coming for help is sufficient enough to help them out. And we are not there to pass judgment because we know very little about what people's actual experience is. And, whether people are employed, nationwide, 36% of the people that come to food distributions have a job as their primary source of income. So people are out there working. So if they show up with a car, the outside observer may say, well, I thought they were hungry. Why do they have a car? Well, the fact is they actually have a job, and the job doesn't pay enough for them to not come for help. So it becomes a very complicated process, and I think we will leave judgment to higher powers, and we will do the right thing because it's the humane thing to do.
And David, you have a lot of help with this, like food pantries from churches and different community organizations and stuff. Is that something that an organization can just call you up to learn how to set up a food pantry in their community that works with you, or how does that work?
Right. All food banks around the country work with nonprofit or faith-based organizations, we are mandated to provide food to low-income people in need of food assistance. So when an organization meets that criteria, then we are able to work with them and set them up as and access the food at the food bank, as well as perhaps provide a direct service distribution at their location.
Great. Well, please keep up the fantastic, important work of both addressing that need as well as getting the word out. David Goodman, the executive director of the Redwood Empire Food Bank, calling us today and being part of the show from Santa Rosa, California. Thanks, David. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you. And I once again, I applaud you for taking an interest on hunger-related issues during the summertime. It is a very special focus. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, you're welcome. It's easy to do during the holidays, but it's an important topic. And if you want to learn more about the Redwood Empire Food Bank in California, go to REF, as in food, B, as in bank.org, or find the local food bank in your area, and both how to get help as well as how to help. Today's show is about hunger and the many causes for hunger. We want to share a more complete light on the work of that is needed and the great work that is being done throughout the country to address hunger in this country on all levels. That was David Goodman with us, and we have a couple more fantastic guests and very creative solutions and ideas and programs in place today on Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Helbert.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And all of that and more when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
Over 25 years ago, my husband and I started a business around our passion for ginger. We called it the Ginger People. Today, you can find our products at natural food stores nationwide. We love ginger. It's what we do. And the more we learned about the amazing properties of ginger, the more we realized that everyone benefits from eating ginger every day. My name is Abby Leeson, and I am with the Ginger People. To learn more about our products, the goodness of ginger, and how it can improve your health, visit gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation as we are discussing hunger on all levels in this society on today's show. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we have other great guests lined up who can speak about hunger and what is being done to address it throughout the country. But first, here's What's in Season with Mark Mulcahy.
Well, thank you, Helge. Today, we're going to talk about cucumbers. And most of us have either grown up or eaten a cucumber, and it's a pretty well-loved, versatile vegetable in our society. But in the 17th century, cucumbers were not that well thought of. They actually forbid people to eat them because they thought they brought on summer diseases, and so kids couldn't eat them. And they were only fit to be fed to, livestock, and they earned the name cowcumber. They used to be called cowcumbers back in the 17th century, but I'm glad that we're not just feeding them to cows now, because I love cucumbers, especially this time of year when there's so many varieties, right? If you're talking about cucumbers, there are three basic varieties of cucumbers. There's slicing cucumbers that we're all pretty familiar with. They're green. They have a pretty decent seed pack in them. A very common cucumber flavor. Sometimes the skin can be bitter on those. Generally, that comes with heat. So the hotter it is, so all this hot weather we've had on the East Coast or that we've even had in different parts of the country, you can get a bitter skin from that. So you can just peel that. But in peeling it, then you don't get all those nutrients that are in the skin, right? Another thing about those types of cucumbers is often in stores, especially not in the summertime, they come waxed. And if they're waxed, then that can not only you don't want to eat that wax, but secondly, if they're grown conventionally or commercially, they could have a lot of pesticide residues, and then they put the wax on there, and so then it's stored in there. So if you do happen to buy a waxed cucumber from a store, you would want to peel it. So the standard slicing cucumber, most of us know. But what I get excited about summer and cucumbers is that the fact that there's so many varieties of cucumbers now. There's Armenians, there's English cucumbers, there's Persian cucumbers. Most of those, you'll notice that they are very long, and they have thin, very thin skin. And they also, all three of those have either a small or very soft seed pack. Which, because some people don't like cucumber seeds. Though these cucumbers also fall into the category of burpless. Some people, when they eat cucumbers, actually have a problem with burping, and these cucumbers don't give you that burping problem. And so those, if you do have a problem with eating cucumbers, you can and burping, you can still eat some with either the Armenian, the English, the Japanese, or Persian cucumbers. And so, and if the skin, the tough skin is something that you don't like, then these are the cucumbers for you too. My favorite cucumbers this time of year are pickling cucumbers, which are short and bumpy, but are very, very crunchy. Even crunchier than a normal cucumber. I love them raw. They have kind of a nutty cucumber flavor. So look for pickling cucumbers or Kirby cucumbers. And lemon cucumbers are my absolute favorite. They're yellow, round. They actually, you could mistake them for a lemon if you saw them on the produce stand. But they have a thin skin, and they have a really, really great sweet flavor, and there's no bitterness to them. So when you're looking for cucumbers, they should be firm, rounded on their edges, and a bright, bright color. Thinner cucumbers generally have less seeds than those that are thicker. So those big, thick doggies you don't want to buy if you don't like seeds. And they should be stored in your refrigerator. They can be stored for several days. But once you open them, then you should seal them in saran wrap really tight to keep them fresh and firm and beautiful for your next salad or sandwich. And that's today's What's in Season.
Wow. That was What's in Season with Mark Mulcahy. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark. Again?
And we're listening to an organic conversation. Mark, you said cucumbers have a problem with burping.
No, cucumbers don't burp, but people who
yes.
eat them burp.
Okay, I was wondering, like, just to be clear on that, when they sit on the counter, they usually don't make a noise whatsoever. Yes, but I love that they were called cowcumbers, and that we took them away from cows. I wonder if
the cows have been protesting actually because they like them.
Yes, but yeah, pickled cucumbers, old German tradition for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of keeping them. I mean, it's a great. Actually, all this came both through flavor and necessity, right? Mm-hmm. It's the way to keep them fresh, mm-hmm. fresh, quote unquote, mm-hmm. throughout the winter. Without refrigeration and canning and all that, you just put them in sour and salt and vinegar, and they stay fine for months and months to come.
And have you ever had a raw pickling cucumber?
I can't say that I did.
You are in for a treat. If you find one in a store, just buy one and just bite into it. The flavor is, like I said, nutty and sweet, and it's just really, really crunchy. If you like
but
crunchy.
But the signage will say pickling cucumber.
Yeah. Or Kirby.
And they're small, right?
Yeah, they could be anywhere from 2 to 6 inches long.
So I have a question. Cornichons, my favorite.
Oh, cornichons.
Are those cornichons cucumbers, or are those just a fancy name for small cucumber that is a regular cucumber?
Well, if they're pickling something, you can pickle anything, because we've even had a show on pickling, right? So it's just a very, very tiny cucumber. So it's barely, it has no seeds in it. It has barely has had any time to even
but
develop.
But is Cornichon a variety, or is it just the way
that
of...
That, you know what? Even with all my produce knowledge, I can't answer that question.
Oh, one of those days.
It's perfect.
Where I have a question that you actually don't know the answer for. We'll find out for you. And we'll get back to you on that one. Cornichons. What is a cornichon? Thank you, Mark. Beautiful. Incredible. We're talking about hunger today on an organic conversation. We heard from David Goodman, the executive director of the Redwood Empire Food Bank, about addressing a national need for hunger, not just throughout the seasons and holiday seasons in December and November, but really hunger is a year-round challenge. We talked briefly about the Marin Organic School Lunch and Gleaning Program. Food that is readily available, often not finding the right family or home. Food more often than not being a problem of distribution, and in other countries even a lack of democracy rather than the sheer availability of produce. And there's great work being done, Mark, throughout the country. Rick Schneider is the founder of MoGrow. We're waiting for his call. I don't think he's with us because of some technical challenges, but he might call us in a minute. MoGrow, short for Mobile Grocery, delivers fruits, vegetables, and other healthy foods by truck to Santo Domingo Pueblo, a Native American community in New Mexico. MoGrow, again, is the brainchild of Rick Schneider, the former and now retired CEO of Sysco, the giant food distribution firm. Great work being done everywhere. We had Oren Hesterman, a food systems expert, with his new book with us in the show 4 weeks ago, and he talked about farmers market programs throughout the country.
Yeah, he was mentioning a program that where they took they gave prescriptions, doctor's prescriptions to people to counteract obesity for fruits and vegetables. And they created a program that's in 26 states around the country where those prescriptions can be taken to farmers markets. And farmers now have the ability to take that prescription and then give people food, fresh produce, for that prescription. And by connecting it with a program called the SNAP program, which is like WIC would be, where you'd get a coupon for food. It's for fresh food, and the SNAP program will double your coupon value. So people now can get a prescription for fresh food, take it to the market, get double the value. The farmers get double the value, so that's fantastic for local farmers. And then they also, anybody who's part of that program has their weight monitored, and they also give them a prescription for exercise programs and greater family activity and recipes for cooking and things like that. So it's a really proactive program of getting food to places often that don't have those foods and supporting local farmers at the same time.
Yeah, a true win-win-win. And how can people find more information on that program?
Well, the Wholesome Wave is the name of the program.
Yes, and Wholesome Wave. And because farmers markets are such a strong part in that program, it addresses the need for community as well as hunger is also a hunger for connection more often than not.
And the website, if they're interested in looking up the Wholesome Wave program, is wholesomewave.org.
And now we're switching gear and go to Ian Cheney, a filmmaker and the co-founder of Truck Farm, because it kind of all starts or is connected to education about food, education about hunger, education about nutrition. He's calling us from Brooklyn, New York, with an unbelievable idea that started a few years ago. Ian, are you with us?
I am. Yeah, glad to be here.
Ian, you're the co-founder of Truck Farm, and it's actually literal in your case. Can you tell us about how this came about and what Truck Farm stands for?
Well, I moved to New York City a few years ago to continue working on documentary films, and moved here with a desire to retain some connection to some of the topics we've been making films about, in particular food and agriculture. So essentially I wanted to have a garden, but didn't have any place to do it. Didn't have a backyard. The community gardens were all full and had waiting lists. And so I was about to get rid of my 86 Dodge pickup truck that my grandfather had given me after I'd finished college, when I started looking at the back of it, and I thought, you know, that's about the size of a typical backyard garden in Brooklyn. So I decided to give it a shot. And with the help of some friendly neighbors and green roof materials, really just took about a day to install what became a 40 square foot or about 1/1000th of an acre garden.
So you literally converted that flatbed or the pickup of your truck. How do you technically do it? Can you just briefly describe it? It seems you're not just tossing in dirt and
right.
putting in a few seats, even though it's close
right.
to that. But what's right. the prepping? If somebody hears this now and is already on his way out to the truck, we don't want to cause any bodily damage to the automobile. What do you do? What are the steps and the layers that you need to put in order for both the truck to survive as well as the plants to survive?
Well, first of all, there's more than one way to plant a truck farm, and so people are actually now out improving on the original quote-unquote design. But here's what I did, which was pretty simple. Drilled a few holes in the actual bed of the truck, particularly in places where it seemed like water would normally pool, to help the drainage, and then laid a few layers of green roof materials, something called a root barrier that prevents the roots from kind of climbing down into the truck, essentially. Something called a drainage mat, which is like a series of little cups. Picture an egg carton or an egg crate, so that water can pool in there for the roots to climb down and get access to. And an erosion blanket to prevent the soil that goes on top from washing away. And then about 6 inches of some kind of lightweight soil. I use something called Gaia soil, which was invented by a guy named Paul Mankiewicz up in the Bronx for green roof applications. But many people use in something like this, something called expanded shale, little clay pellets. And then on top of that, a couple inches of topsoil and compost. The key is to just keep it light enough so the truck doesn't collapse, but also enough of a structure that the plants can get a firm footing and get access to the water and nutrients they need.
So how do you rust-proof the truck? I would think that 2 years later, the bed must be completely...
Well, I didn't rust-proof my truck because I decided it was going to be too expensive, but some other truck farmers, we now have actually 23 truck farms going on 25 all across the country, and some folks have essentially put in what's like a spray-in bed liner for their trucks that really protects the bed of the truck.
And yours is a Dodge. It's a Detroit build, so there we go.
I also figured this was kind of the last, you know, like the space shuttle's last mission here.
Yes.
I just said, we're just going to go for it, and whatever happens, happens.
That's great.
So, Ian, you just started mentioning about other trucks around the country that where a fleet has left Brooklyn. But I first read about your program in Boston, and I was just wondering. So you planted a garden. You planted a garden in the back of your truck. You had this great idea to do that. So can you elaborate on the program now about what actually by planting it in the back of your truck?
Right.
What happened after that?
Well, what happened after that is I noticed people, especially young people, were drawn to the truck. It was kind of a curiosity. It was just parked there on the side of the street. I had a little time-lapse camera going to capture to document the growing season as the plants sprouted, because I thought, well, maybe this could turn into an interesting film or video project. So two things emerged out of those initial days. One was a short film that's completed now and in film festivals and community screenings around the country. It's about 48 minutes long, and it's called Truck Farm, and it documents truck farms' adventures around New York City, out meeting other similarly quirky urban farms and asking questions about, or the film asks questions about, what's the role of urban agriculture, what's its potential, what can we make of it, what are some different ways of approaching it. And then the other thing that emerged from those early days was an outreach and education project where I started with my longtime collaborator, Kurt Ellis. We started driving the truck around to visit schools and community centers and summer camps and farmers markets. Increasingly, we got invited all over the city, even to places like Sotheby's Auction House to show the truck farm, because it was a way of engaging people in thinking outside the box about growing food in the city, in showing young people their first glimpse of a tomato plant or something growing, also injecting a little bit of whimsy into the conversation about how we eat and how we grow food.
Really, truly thinking outside the box truck. We're talking exactly, with Ian Cheney, filmmaker and co-founder of The Truck Farm, truck-farm.com, for more information. Here on An Organic Conversation today, I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Ian, stay with us. We want to hear what has come out of all this. You really wanting to grow vegetables for yourself, now a national movement of pickup trucks being both educational as well as providing food. And it's going beyond because you're bringing your filmmaking history back and experience back into this project. Stay with us. All that as we're addressing hunger and creative ways of educating about food here on An Organic Conversation today. We'll be right back after the break.
Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Hi, my name is Abby Leeson and I am the co-founder of The Ginger People. You can find our products in natural food stores near you. From delicious ginger drinks, sauces, spreads, ginger chews, baked goods, to skincare products. We love ginger. It's what we do. Add the benefits of ginger to your life, and you get that little kick, too. I am Abby Leeson, and I'm with the Ginger People. For inspiration around ginger, go to gingerpeople.com.